I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the second half of our interview with Zach Lynch, author of The Neuro Revolution, How Brain Science is Changing the World. You can find the first half of this interview at IEET.org. One of the areas which you talk about in your book is neurowarfare and the use of these technologies to enhance soldiers and to potentially do psychological ops against other countries. And you mentioned that you have been contacted by many people who think that they have been experimented upon or currently being controlled in some way by the federal government. I have as well. And I've interviewed Jonathan Moreno, who wrote a book about this a couple of years ago. He's constantly contacted by people. So there's a lot of paranoid concern about this out in the public and a lot of legitimate concern, I think, about the ways that the more covert national security interests of our societies may use these even in putatively democratic societies. What you know, you have probably gotten some inside scoop on what DARPA is working on and the different kinds of, and you talk about some of the research in the book about research on how to enhance soldiers' behavior, keep them awake longer, make them more resilient to stress and so forth. What are your reflections on how open and accountable that kind of research is?
You know, like every new set of tools that humanity has ever developed, neurotech holds both promise and peril. Just as steam engine technologies were, ultimately used and gave rise to tanks that were used in World War One, and microprocessors, ultimately gave rise to mobile phone activated IEDs, neurotechnologies are going to be used for the purposes of war. And through my research and investigations in trying to understand what was happening in this sort of emerging neurowarfare arena, it was very interesting to sort of understand where, progress was being made, where progress wanted to be made, and where things were actually going. Neurowarfare really isn't something that's completely new. Neurotoxins and gases used in World War One on a vast scale. Since then, chemical weapons conventions have sort of been able to stop their use to a broad degree, but this really hasn't stopped governments from sort of pushing the envelope. The DoD is doing a lot of research into biomarkers that will help reveal naturally quick reaction time, high visual acuity, information retention. So it's not that they're just using these technologies to figure out how they might be able to enhance or improve or enable, soldier performance sort of on the battlefield, but how might they be able to pre-select individuals who will have increased resiliency to perhaps post-traumatic stress disorder. So they're also using these technologies to sort of help them potentially, and they're not using them for this today, sift through individuals that they then, go forward and invest hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in training them to, participate in these forward operations. During forward operations, some of the technologies and techniques that the DoD is really interested in is anything that will extend their physical stamina, improve their cognitive clarity. And one area of interesting research is research into truncating emotional trauma that's inherent in face-to-face combat.
So propranolol research that is targeted at post-traumatic stress disorder, that's one avenue of that.
That's definitely one avenue. We can get a glimmer of where some of this research is going and what is being funded by DARPA. And from my perspective, I was happy to see, at least in the, National Academy of Sciences meetings that I participated in and other meetings, that there was a general strong interest in including neuroethicists in most of the discussions, if not all of the discussions that I was involved with. had, you know, some preeminent neuroethicist who, you know, whose role is to think and write and discuss about, you know, some of the ethical issues of some of these advancing technologies. So from the perspective of whether or not, you know, they're willing to be analyzed by, you know, the outside world, I took that as a good note.
I'm glad to hear that. A lot of the concern, as far as I'm concerned, about memory suppression and so forth has been pretty hyperbolic, because the technologies like propranolol have not actually been about suppressing memory. It's about getting rid of the fear, the fight or flight reaction that gets bonded to particular memories.
Right. It's calming down the amygdala.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But we might eventually get to the point where you could actually carve up your memory, and that would be a much more problematic future, something we do need to talk about pretty seriously.
Right.
You get into neurotheology in the book, looking for God in the brain. There's been an awful lot of research on this in the last 10 years. What impacts do you think that this is going to have on religion? I'll just preload the question by saying I have written about this and argued that I think a lot of religions are going to incorporate these technologies and try to use them to enhance religion and moral behavior. But what are your reflections on that?
Well, I hope we do. And you know, for those who aren't familiar with neurotheology, it's really this new area of research that seeks to understand the neurobiology of spiritual and religious experiences. You know, today there are about 6.8 billion people on the earth. Over two-thirds self-identify with religion. There are over 2 billion Christians, 1 billion Muslims, 750 million Hindus, 300 million Buddhists, and over 14 million of the Jewish faith. Now, these are huge numbers and represent billions of reasons why we might want to use, you know, our new tools that humanity has developed to learn what underpins all of this belief. So in this quest, you know, neurotheological researchers have scanned the brains of Buddhist monks and Franciscan nuns, Pentecostal Christians, Carmelite nuns, you know, down the list of faiths. And although they have yet to really uncover, you know, some common thread among these different spiritual traditions, there are a couple of things that I think are sort of interesting to note. First of all, as they're doing this research, I think, you know, one of the most amazing brain scans would be of a person who is experiencing a religious or spiritual experience that showed absolutely no difference in activation patterns in their brain scans. That would be really hard to describe in religious and in scientific terms. But where I think this is sort of going, you know, further down the road, is, and many researchers have brought this up, is that, you know, just as Copernicus's notion of the heliocentric vision of the, you know, Earth revolving around the sun transformed how humanity looks at ourselves in the universe, and just as Charles Darwin's theory of evolution changed yet again how humanity views ourselves in the context of the global ecology and our life history with the other organisms on this planet, you know, many researchers assert that the deeper we dive into the brain, that there may develop a new neuro-spiritual tradition, which will yet again transform how humanity looks at ourselves in sort of the greater cosmos. And that has profound societal and cultural implications going, you know, sort of moving forward. Do I think this will happen in the next 5 years, 10 years? No. But, you know, the more we develop these technologies to peer deeper into the minds of individuals and sort of trying to understand what essence there might be among these different spiritual and religious traditions, it's pretty profound when you start to think about how this might transform how we view ourselves in the greater cosmos.
You know, on the one hand, it has been interpreted to validate the notions of faith by many, and the argument that, of course, if we were created, the Creator would have put some kind of transmitter node inside of our brain that would have allowed us to have these experiences. But the experiences are variable, and there's some evidence that there are genetic differences between people that make some people more susceptible to belief in God or to mystical experiences. And that seems like a pretty capricious creator that would vary the ability to experience these things between people. But at any rate, I think you're right that, you know, if for instance, homosexuality is determined to have some kind of biological causation or some, you know, neurochemical causation, one of the things I think Christians are already thinking about is how they might then use neurotechnology to suppress sinful desires, not just homosexual, but all kinds of sinful desires. And in that sense, I think there might be neo-Sharia, neo-forms of morality that are using these technologies to kind of reinforce their own notions of moral behavior and not just trying to achieve spiritual experience.
Right. And from my perspective, that's just extraordinarily unfortunate. But that's what we need to begin to discuss.
Right, exactly.
And that was sort of the genesis of why I wanted to write this broad book that could spark, a public dialogue rather than diving deep into a particular subject and then giving it some historical context. You know, in this whole area of neurotheology, I sort of find it very interesting that some people with epilepsy experience, spiritual experiences during their seizures, that individuals who have deep brain stimulators implanted for Parkinson's sometimes have spiritual sensations and out-of-body experiences. And so you can actually tap into, by stimulating the brain, some of these feelings of the greatness of, of these religious and spiritual feelings. And so I think there's a lot of research to be done, and it'll be very interesting to see where it goes.
Now, in the final part of our chat, I want to address two questions that you closed the book with. One is enhancement and enablement, and then connected to that, this issue of the Neurotechnology Industry Organization and its research agenda, its corporate agenda, its research agenda. So let's address enhancement. One of the big problems with enhancement is that in the current regulatory and research environment in D.C. And in Europe, you can't propose that you want to do clinical research on enhancement. you won't get funding for it. It has to be targeted towards therapy for some kind of disease. How big an obstacle is this going to be in the next wave of clinical research that has enhancement implications that we have to tie everything towards therapeutic ends?
I think there are sort of a couple of different points to be made around this issue. The first is that we live in a highly connected, globalized economy, and there are other venues, other nations that have different legal structures that might be more friendly towards that type of research. Whether or not that's China or Singapore or Russia or India, there are other places other than the United States and Western Europe that innovators and entrepreneurs can go to test out their theories. The real issue around that, though, is, are these technologies going to be safe, and are they going to be effective, and do you want to be exposing individuals to technologies that could cause either short-term or grave long-term harm when being a healthy, normal human is an adequate, let's just say, way of existing. And so we just need to be very careful about putting people in harm's way to test out one's theory. So that aside, this whole idea of, enhancement, or which is a term I'm not very comfortable using, and I think sort of clouds the actual conversation that we should be having, because I don't think many of the tools and technologies and techniques that are being developed are actually enhancement. I don't think they take you beyond, in the case of, cognoceuticals, I don't think they take you beyond the IQ of Einstein. I don't think they enhance you beyond sort of the higher percentiles of what humanity is currently capable of. What I think they do is they enable individuals in the mid to lower percentiles to perform more effectively in perhaps the upper percentiles. And I think this is what we're seeing with the use of college students, who use Adderall and Ritalin to improve their mental performance. So you have this off-label usage of new drugs in the future, perhaps, devices, non-invasive devices, to improve one's cognitive performance. You've got software programmers, financiers, even poker players that are using these. But there are important ethical issues, again, with using drugs that were developed to treat illnesses like ADHD or Alzheimer's or cognitive impairment associated with schizophrenia in healthy, normal individuals. There are issues of safety, there are issues around health, there are issues around fairness, and even in the long term, sort of coercion. There's this, tension. Because in the near future, you can imagine, if you're, 50-year-old living in Boston and you're competing for a software programming project, which represents maybe a year of income to you, and you're competing against a 25-year-old in Mumbai, there's going to be some sort of inherent coercive force pushing you to potentially use these, because you don't know if that 25-year-old is going to be using these, neuro-competitive technologies, if you will. So there are a whole host of issues around, that we need to be concerned about. But, we're really on the tip of the iceberg here. With over 100 drugs currently in clinical development to treat some form of memory loss, it's expected that, a small handful, and it's only going to take one, will be developed over the next decade that could improve the memory retention of healthy, normal individuals to a relatively safe degree. And once that one gets out, it's only going to take a small number of individuals to begin to be using that to improve, to transform the basis of not only educational competition, but business competition. And that's where we really get into, issues around our emerging neurosociety. And that's why I think having these discussions now on a broad social scale is so important.
I've argued for the decriminalization, or it's not criminal, but the deregulation of modafinil for quite some time, because there's been no evidence over the last 5-6 years that it's been seeping out into more general use, that there's a significant side effect profile to modafinil that would warrant it's having to be a prescription drug for, currently excessive daytime sleepiness, whatever the diagnosis is that you need to get it. I don't think that we're in a climate yet where there's going to be a push for sufficient cognitive liberty protection and over-the-counterization of these kinds of relatively safe enhancing drugs. I would like there to be more of a climate for that in Washington, but I don't see it there yet.
Right, and you're not alone. But I sort of bring up the context of we live in a global economy. And so
you think
we might
China,
see these changes happening outside of our, the United States jurisdiction.
And that would put pressure on us here.
Right.
Well, so China is significantly, the public polling that I've seen in China and India, they're significantly more optimistic and favorable towards any kind of enhancement technologies, genetic enhancement, et cetera. Do you think that as China becomes wealthier and they have a relatively liberal attitude towards these technologies, that they will have productivity advantages and international competitive advantages with us, which will create an international pressure to adopt more liberal policies?
I have no doubt that is true.
I mean, I hate to use that, the kind of the threat,
right,
as an argument, but it does seem like one of the possible scenarios of the future.
Right. That is one of the possible, driving factors that will accelerate the use of these things worldwide.
Now,
but it's important that the be safe and effective. I mean, going back to the modafinil example, while there's anecdotal evidence that modafinil is safe and effective to be used, by healthy, normal individuals, we still haven't done a clinical trial. So maybe the government needs to get involved in doing clinical trials to see if these things can be used in healthy, normal humans. I don't think that's necessarily the role of the government, but some sort of research needs to be done, right? Some sort of clinical trial.
Pharma has been very involved in attempting to expand the budget for the FDA because the FDA's structural inadequacies have been a real bottleneck on innovation. Is the neurotechnology industry organization that you guys have organized, are you working on FDA reform as well and trying to improve the innovation pipeline?
Right. So the neurotechnology industry organization really focuses on, bringing together companies involved in commercial neuroscience, leading brain research institutes, and patient advocacy groups in order to, quote, give the brain a voice, if you will. And one of the leading initiatives that we have been focused on over the past 2 years is a national neurotechnology initiative. And this was introduced into Congress in March by Senator Patty Murray out of Washington State, as well as Patrick Kennedy in the House from Rhode Island, and Ileana Rose-Layton in Miami. And the focus of this legislation is to accelerate the development of treatments for the brain and nervous system. These are neurological diseases and psychiatric illnesses. These are, you know, nearly 100 million Americans currently suffer from a neurological disease and psychiatric illness. And it's taking too long to develop new treatments. And so the focus of this bill is five sort of key points. The first is to develop a national coordination office based in Health and Human Services that would coordinate the neuroscience research occurring at the DOD, VA, and NIH. The second piece of the legislation is additional funding for the NIH's blueprint for neuroscience research. This would increase coordination among the 16 institutes at the NIH that are focused on the brain and nervous system out of the 27. So once we have national coordination, we have coordination within the NIH itself, which is where we spend the bulk of our research dollars in the United States on brain and nervous system research, about $6.5 billion a year. The next sort of key bottleneck that's stemming the development of treatments is the ability to take this research, leverage it, and commercialize it. So there is money in the bill for the NIH's SBIR, the Small Business Innovation Research Program grants, to help researcher entrepreneurs take their brilliant ideas and move them into the pipeline and move them into the commercial sector where they can start getting private funding for these new treatments and diagnostics for these disorders and diseases. The fourth bottleneck, then, is the FDA itself. And so there's money in the legislation to provide additional training for the staff that they have, as well as hire new staff with sufficient understanding of advancing neurotechnologies so that they can begin to help these technologies move through the system at a faster rate. There are a whole host of companies that have been impacted by the inability of the FDA to adequately and quickly review their clinical trial data. And indeed, it's caused some companies to go under. I mean, these companies have large staff that they employ that sort of are on hold while the FDA is, and they can't let them go because they've got other clinical research projects sort of moving forward while the FDA is reviewing their research. So yes, we're specifically focused on trying to figure out how to alleviate bottlenecks that are stemming the development of these treatments. Now, the fifth component of legislation is, because it's a national neurotechnology initiative, we wanted to make sure that there was some funding to analyze the ethical, legal, and societal implications of advancing neuroscience. So there's $10 million a year that's focused on these LC issues regarding advancing neuroscience.
That's wonderful. I'm sure I'm going to be a side beneficiary of some of that in the future years.
I hope so. I hope, the whole neuroethics community really is able to take advantage of these, this increased funding.
Well, this is an incredible success story, the Neurotechnology Industry Organization. You hit at a pretty good moment with the stimulus package going through. Was it a part of that mega stimulus package?
Oh, no. The legislation has been introduced. It has not been
Hasn't been voted out yet. Okay.
No. We're working on that. Right, your congressman.
Okay. But it looks good?
Things are moving forward. We're optimistic. It's a tough time to get expensive legislation through Congress, but we're optimistic, and I'll be in D.C. next week up on the Hill talking to congressmen and senators on behalf of the industry in support of the legislation. So,
well, something that you've woven because of your involvement in this and the other the blog and the newsletter that you put out, you've woven information about the economic impacts of mental illness and depression and Alzheimer's and all the different things that these potential technologies could treat, and that the economic benefits to society if we get further development of the technology. So I think there's such a strong case to be made for the ripple effect that this kind of investment would make.
Right. In the United States alone, the annual economic burden of brain-related illnesses has reached over $1.3 trillion a year.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, you know, a $200 million a year bill that could potentially, within 10 years, double the number of treatments that are on the market for these diseases could be a huge boon to, you know, saving money on a national scale.
Well, I'm sure every congressman doesn't want to get Alzheimer's, so it's a pretty easy pitch to make for some of them. Now, if folks want to find out more, they can go to theneurorevolution.com. The book is called The Neuro Revolution, How Brain Science is Changing Our World. Zach writes the Brainwaves blog, which is read widely. You can subscribe for, it's a pretty pricey newsletter, but it's an industry newsletter called Neurotech Insights, if you're in that industry. And the firm is Neuro Insights. I want to really thank you for joining us today, Zach.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Jay.
That was the second half of our interview with Zach Lynch, author of The Neuro Revolution. You can find the first half at ieet.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future. That was the second half of our interview with Zach Lynch, author of The Neuro Revolution. You can find the first half at ieet.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.